Today, is Britain really a beacon to the world when it comes to tackling racism? Last summer, tens of thousands of people took to the streets across the UK in response to the death of George Floyd in America.
It was a huge trigger for some of the most widespread anti-racism protests that we've seen in centuries in the UK.
The Guardian's community affairs correspondent, Amna Modin, followed them from the start.
But people weren't just coming out to the streets in huge numbers just because of that horrible death of George Floyd. You know, I noticed very early on in the protests that I was covering that the anger was very British, the issues were very British.
We need to bring it domestically. We need to remember that the UK is not innocent.
People were listing names of people who had died here.
Who will have a moment's silence?
They were rooted in the British experience.
First of all, we have to acknowledge that when thousands of people march peacefully for Black Lives Matter, I can't ignore the strength of their feeling.
In the midst of these protests, Boris Johnson announced that he was setting up a government commission to examine racial inequalities, saying he wanted to change the narrative on race.
Because I think what has slightly been lost in all this is the story of success.
Last week, that report was published.
The publication of this review was meant to be a moment of tightening divisions, but it's clear there is now anger, disillusionment and disappointment.
It's an insult to everybody and anybody who experiences institutional racism across this country.
It's been condemned by campaigners.
The government is clearly in denial about the persisting, insidious effect of racism and the fact that it actually exists.
Criticised by individuals like Doreen Lawrence for giving the green light to racists. And even those who contributed to it say they were ignored for raising inconvenient truths. On Thursday, the Prime Minister appeared to publicly distance himself from it. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, why the government's race report has sparked such a furious backlash. Amna, over the years, there have been several landmark reports about the issue of race in Britain, often prompted by huge scandals or deep injustices, whether it was the McPherson report following the murder of Stephen Lawrence, or more recently the report into the Windrush scandal. What was it the government wanted to achieve with this one? And who did they turn to work on it?
I'm not too sure exactly what they wanted to achieve with this one.
That's the question. This was written on the back of a fag packet yesterday to assuage the Black Lives Matter protest.
Because when this report was announced, one of the very early criticism of it was we don't need another inquiry, we don't need another report. Like you said, there's been so many.
There are 110 recommendations in the Angelini review into deaths in police custody. Implement them.
People said stop, look at the recommendations and begin to implement them.
There are 30 recommendations in the Home Office review into the Windrush scandal. Implement them.
David Lammy said that quite powerfully last summer.
Get on with the action. Legislate. Move. You're in government. Do something.
But the government, you know, said, no, we want to go through these reports and see which recommendations are relevant for now. So they tapped Dr. Tony Sewell to be the chairman of this commission. And for the critics, that's when the problems began.
Let's talk to Dr. Tony Sewell. He's managing director of
the charity. Criticisms of using Tony Sewell for this report?
Good morning.
I think the critics pointed to Sewell's past attempts to play down the effects of institutional racism.
There are disparities. I think there are disparities based on race, but they're not necessarily caused by racism.
And focus instead on placing, you know, responsibility on the Black British community.
For example, in the Black community, there's a real issue about single parents. you know.
And people just felt like that was a bit inappropriate for a commission that looks into racial disparity.
We are confusing lots of things here, trying to kind of find the devil, when really there's lots of internal things that we've got to deal with.
But also because The Guardian revealed last summer a column that he wrote in The Voice in reference to the UK's first openly gay football player, Justin Fashanu. He used the phrase tortured queens and playing hide and seek. So eyebrows were raised when he was asked to step in.
So he's heading up what is quite a racially diverse panel, which has put this report together. What else do we know about them?
So there's a wide variety of backgrounds, I'd say, that from a career perspective on the commission. But the average age is just over 50. And there's only one person in their 20s. So it is people who have grown up in the 60s and 70s and 80s.
You think anti-racism is becoming weaponized across the political spectrum. Is that fair?
One person that is really important is Munira Mirza.
Well, I think reports like this tend to give an overly negative picture of how ethnic groups are doing in Britain today.
She's the head of Downing Street's policy unit, and she's seen as a particular influence on Boris Johnson on race and cultural issues. She oversaw the appointments of the commission's panel.
And by framing it in terms of racial injustice, it's giving a very misleading picture of why there are disparities.
And she's always been a long-time outspoken critic of previous governments' attempt to tackle structural factors behind racial inequality. So there was this feeling of, well, people have come into this commission with a viewpoint already in mind.
You read the report when it came out last week. Mm-hmm. What are its main conclusions?
It notes that while racism and racial injustice do exist, geography, family influence, socioeconomic background, culture and religion have far greater impact on life chances in the UK than race do. In the foreword from Chairman Tony Sewell, he said that communities are haunted by historic racism and that there was like a reluctance to acknowledge that the UK has become a much open and fairer society. And it said that the UK is kind of a beacon for racial equality. It's a model for other white majority countries. It says that, and I thought this was the most interesting, it said its findings present a new race agenda for the country. It marks a significant shift in government policy.
It was a report intended to tackle concerns that millions around the country have to deal with. But what do those who experience racism on a regular basis actually think of it?
It kind of seeks to kind of almost invalidate the experiences of countless people of colour. I don't see how you can possibly say that race is a lesser issue than it is.
I think probably a lot of people, Amna, were probably quite surprised by some of the conclusions in this report, especially after everything that happened last summer, as you talked about earlier. What did you make of it? And also, what did you make of the language and the overall tone of this report?
It seemed like it was really interested in countering what a lot of Black Lives Matter protesters were saying last year. In the summary of the report that was released, it infamously said the idealism of well-intentioned young people claiming the dominant feature in society is institutional racism achieves, and I quote, little beyond alienating the decent centre ground.
Now young people across the country come together and say, yes, Black lives do matter. And guess what?
They said this is a very unhelpful way of trying to bring about change.
Boris Johnson stands in their way.
I'm sure that some of those who protested last summer took part in the public consultation that was launched by the commission behind this report. Over 2,000 people responded. And The Guardian reported last week that many of them used the word structural and institutional in their responses. And one of the biggest things to come out of this report is around language. The report calls for an end to the use of the acronym BAME for Black, Asian and Minority Ethnic People. Why?
Yeah, this is a very long time coming. A lot of people have always been very frustrated in the way that you've got white people and then just everyone else clumped together in what they believe to be quite an unhelpful term. But I think it's worth pointing out that there's two different camps in those who want to get rid of BAME, and there's one that's a bit more right-wing than the other. The more left-wing camp is actually just saying we need to dig a bit deeper into this, that within that group different groups are experiencing different types of racism. You know, we shouldn't just collapse everyone's experience into one thing. Whereas I think the more right-wing criticism of BAME touches on those arguments, definitely, but it also really emphasises this idea of individualism. We should be looking at what individual people need to succeed in society and just really move away from ethnic groupings like that as a whole.
It's a difficult one, isn't it? Because we as journalists love to use acronyms and it's a really convenient way, isn't it, for us to write about large swathes of the population. Mm. You know, what do you think about the mention of this in this report?
I think it's interesting and it's one that people have taken up and they like that bit of the report, even the critics do. At the same time, I think it also shows personally for me why it is really important to have terms like this. You know, the reason why we have terms like BAME is because there is a specific experience of not being white in this country.
Anna, let's look at some of these specific areas of British life that this report focuses on and start with race and education, which is something The Guardian has investigated recently. Can you tell us first what this report found about how different ethnic groups are performing at school?
I think in one of the most controversial sections of the report, it kind of argues education has been the best success story of British ethnic minority experience.
The education system totally declaring itself institutionally racist. It's not the case. In fact, We have found the complete opposite. The vast majority of ethnic minorities, bar, say, for example, Black Caribbean, are actually doing better than the white majority.
And I think there is truth to that. Many children from ethnic minority communities do very well or better than white pupils. But I think the reason why that's controversial is because the report suggests, you know, if you've got, for example, Black African groups doing very well in the classroom, but in that very same classroom, you've got Black Caribbean students not achieving well, well, surely the issue isn't race. And I think that's quite a controversial conclusion to come to. And people have been very critical of that. I mean, the tone of this section is a marked contrast to, like you mentioned, the Guardian investigation on race and UK education and what we've been reporting on for the last year. You know, the Guardian found 60,000 racist incidents in schools. These kind of have huge impacts on a student's ability to learn and significantly higher exclusion rates for pupils from minority communities. I mean, can all of that just be brought down to individual behaviours and not, again, like those issues of structural racism?
I mean, as you sort of imply, this does seem quite baffling. I mean, if the commission is saying that structural racism isn't behind the disparities they identify, how do they explain them?
Well, this is the thing, something that I noticed when I was going through the report is there's just about 10 or a dozen mentions of the term institutional and not that much more of the term structural. But when I put in family, you know, 100 times it came up. So the report really began to focus on what's happening within families that can explain these disparities and not necessarily what's happening in the public sphere that might explain why certain groups are doing much worse than others.
I mean, that to me almost seems quite stigmatising to place responsibility so firmly on the home. Mm. And particularly when you're dividing it down racial lines, that would seem to imply then that it's, you know, certain minority cultures that are behind these disparities between different racial groups at school.
Exactly. It does go into single parent families. And it's just like, well, we have heard these arguments before in the UK, but it's been a few decades, you know, like since what, the 90s, where mainstream politicians are there talking about single mums and the impact of single mums on why students aren't doing very well. You know, it just feels, I don't know, I feel like I'm going back in time a bit.
There's a specific quote that I want to read you all in the report. There's a new story about the Caribbean experience, which speaks to the slave period not only being about profit and suffering, but how culturally African people transformed themselves into remodeled African and Britons. What do you all make of that?
And then there is this astonishing assertion in the report that a new story should be told about slavery. What does that really mean?
I'm still trying to figure that out. It is, I think, the most contentious passage in the report. I mean,
oh gosh,
I don't know what they were trying to say in that sentence.
It's almost as though they're trying to put a positive spin on slavery.
But it's gone down very, very badly.
I consider that comment to be deeply offensive.
With a lot of people, including Labour.
It's really deeply disappointing.
You know, who said the government needs to urgently explain how they've come to publish content which Labour alleges glorifies the slave trade, and they need to disassociate themselves from these remarks. The government hasn't, but yeah.
I think that quote in itself represents how this report is very convoluted and unaware of its own assessment.
Let me tell you, no way do we, in this report, we really do kind of acknowledge the existence of racism. You'll see there's no ducking the issue of racism.
In fact, Tony Sewell has said in response to the backlash, essentially, to this part of the report, that it's absurd to suggest that the commission is trying to downplay the evil of the slave trade, and it's ridiculous and offensive, and that the report merely says that in the face of the inhumanity of slavery, African people preserve their humanity and culture. He's arguing that they are trying to tell a different story on slavery, isn't he?
Yes. I wondered, you know, is this an attempt to talk about the resilience within ethnic minority communities in the UK? But it was just phrased in an utterly bizarre way.
I mean, utterly bizarre. I mean, I think the phrasing that stands out to me, as it probably did a lot of people, is that describing it as the Caribbean experience. And I think I read one critic that said you can't make out that the slave trade was anything like some sort of Thompson's Holiday cruise. This is just incredibly offensive.
No, definitely. And I think what's particularly sad about that bit was talking to so many young people who are so hungry for a change in their curriculum, who are so desperate to see a curriculum that represents themselves, that represents their backgrounds and their families and their cultures and their community, so they too can sit in that classroom and feel like that they belong, that this was the response to that. I feel like that was very disappointing for a lot of people.
The next area I wanted to look at is the world of work, where we know that at the top of many of the best paying and most prestigious professions, it still looks very white. For example, in 2018, 584 Black Caribbean applicants applied for the civil service fast stream, and not a single one of them succeeded. What has the Sewell report said about all of this?
I think what's particularly interesting about that stat was when, you know, Radio Times put that statistic to one of the commissioners, they responded, well, that could be an anomaly, you know, and it just kind of really speaks to the frustration that a lot of people have that something as stark as that could be dismissed so easily. The commissioner insisted that the civil service was not institutionally racist, and it just kind of begs the question, well, what kind of evidence are you looking at, and how are you interpreting this evidence? You know, they point to the pay gap between ethnic minority and white workers has been falling, and it's lowest level at almost a decade, you know, and of course, like, yes, progress has been made, but from what is also extremely important. So I do think this section of the report has been one that's been criticised quite significantly of cherry-picking data, and then unions describing it as deeply, deeply cynical. The GMB union, one of the bigger unions in the UK, said institutional racism exists. It's the lived experience of millions of Black and ethnic minority workers.
Let's turn to one of the most contentious issues when discussing race in this country, and the focus of many previous government inquiries, policing. We know there are staggering racial discrepancies over things such as the use of stop and search powers, the overrepresentation of ethnic minorities in prisons, the lack of diversity in the police. You've reported on this over the years, and we've made podcasts about this. What has the report added to this body of existing work?
There's a significant bit of the report is on crime and policing, about 60 pages. But it's notable that it's all largely about policing, with virtually no mention of courts or racial disparities in the criminal justice system. The section on stop and search is interesting. While it's broadly supportive, the report kind of stresses that the way it can be often used to target minority ethnic young people for minor drug offences, like carrying some weed on you, is pushing them towards the court. And the report really questions that. And then among the recommendations for police forces is ensuring that officers are wearing body-worn cameras particularly when the stop and search is a contested one, and to divert low-level drug arrests away from the justice system. And it calls for like local recruitment. I thought that was very interesting for police forces. You know, the police force needs to be reflective of the local community that it polices. And I think that's something a lot of criminal justice advocates, equal rights campaigners have been calling for a while.
So in this particular sector, are people quite welcoming of some aspects of this part of the report?
I think so. The people are like, you know, welcoming of the more liberal aspects, but there are also criticisms. It focuses quite significantly on the causes of crime. And that's on purpose. You know, I went back to the researcher who was commissioned to do this section. He said the commission were interested primarily in the drivers of crime more than other factors that might shape patterns of policing. But then also, you know, if you go and look, because they've released all the research, it's very nuanced, that bit. You know, the stuff that they've asked these academics to look into is really, really nuanced. It's really interesting. And it actually paints a different picture to the conclusion that the commission's come to, I find.
Really?
It argues that structural and systematic racism does exist if you look at that research.
It's interesting listening to you say that, Amna. Dalbabu, who is one of the UK's most senior British Asian police officers who took part in this report, said last week...
Well, if I'm really honest, Michelle, I regret going. It was a Fawlty Towers-like experience. The commissioners lacked diversity of thought. They are all of one ilk. And I think we've seen that in the report.
And what does the report go on to say about the rising number of race hate crimes that are now being reported?
They say that the definition of hate crimes have increased over the last few years. More people are reporting hate crimes because they feel comfortable to. But this commission sees that as a progressive thing, like a good thing that people feel comfortable to utilise these channels. And they kind of criticise what they said was an overly pessimistic worldview from some anti-racist activists, and just said, you know, that's just not true. That doesn't exist.
But surely any hate crime is a bad thing. That just because people are reporting them more, that means people are still experiencing them.
No,
I don't really understand that.
No, yeah, exactly. And I think that's what was quite frustrating for people.
These are just some of the nurses, doctors, health and social care assistants, all who've sacrificed their lives to save ours. The Black, Asian and minority ethnic workforce in the NHS are being hit hard by this deadly virus, and we need to know why.
Amna, this report arrives at the end of the first year of this pandemic for us, and that has highlighted the huge number of inequalities that exist in this country.
If you take two people of the same age living in the same local authority, a Black Caribbean would be 1.7 times more likely to die than a white person, a Bangladeshi twice as likely, a Pakistani nearly three times, and a Black African 3.5 times more likely to die than a white person.
You only have to look at who is dying from COVID to see that these figures run along racial lines. What has the report said about this?
It's suggested that it has less to do with institutional racism or racism and more to do with these other issues around housing, around the fact that BAME communities are more likely to do frontline work, and then also about specific health conditions that are more prominent in these communities. The really bizarre thing is that for a lot of people, the fact that all these issues are more likely to occur in these communities is a sign towards structural and institutional racism. But the commission kind of wrote, well, we think these other issues are the problem and not race. And what's really interesting is, you know, as soon as the report kind of came out, the ONS, which is a hugely well-respected statistical agency, has come out to criticise some of those conclusions, to point out there are specific disparities, and even when you factor in socioeconomic factors, race is still a huge issue.
You've spent the last year focusing specifically in your reporting on the impact COVID has had on minority communities. How do you feel when you read in the report lines like, even over the course of the pandemic, despite the higher COVID-19 death rates, overall mortality in Black and South Asian groups has not been higher than for white groups? You know, when you think about that and you think about the people you've spoken to, what do you think?
I think it's something I read, and it was a double take for me and for a lot of people who were reading it. and it sparked a lot of anger for understandable reasons. People have seen significant numbers of their loved ones die. You know, we did a podcast together about one neighbourhood in Bren.
It says the Somali population increased by 100%.
Yes, and absolutely.
That saw over 30 members die during that first wave.
He's the one who really gave me the lift that night. Even though he was tired, he was saying that he had a long day and then has asthma. But then
she waved goodbye to him, and that would be the last time she saw him. That's just heartbreaking statistics, and it's just very difficult for a report to come back and tell them that's just not the case.
Coming up, was this report the reason Boris Johnson's race advisor resigned last week?
Boris Johnson's most senior black advisor has resigned following the debate over Downing Street's controversial report on race disparities in the UK that came out yesterday.
Amna, the day after the commission's findings were published, Boris Johnson's advisor on race, Samuel Kassamu, resigned. Downing Street has denied this is connected to the report, but how significant is this?
So this is really interesting. Samuel wanted to resign in February.
When he talked about the government pursuing a politics steeped in division.
He essentially just accused the government of not taking the issue of race and the issues that affect minority communities seriously and for playing in a really dangerous culture war. He was talked down from that resignation from ministers. But the day after this report's come out, he's confirmed that, yes, he has now resigned. I think that speaks very powerfully that Number 10's most senior black advisor has walked away.
There's a lot to take in here, but throughout it all is this elephant in the room that you identified at the beginning, that the commission has largely ignored the concept of structural or institutional racism in favour of looking at the issues through the lens of economics, geography and family units. How has that been received?
Badly. I think very, very badly. People are very, very frustrated. They felt like we made huge progress in the way that we talk about race and structural racism, and the fact that there was a huge upswell from last summer's Black Lives Matter protest, where loads of institutions began to look at themselves and ask, what are we doing to ensure that we're racially progressive? So it feels like in many ways, one step forward was taken, and then this comes and there's another step backwards.
One of the most eye-catching claims in the report is that Britain is now a beacon to the world on race relations, supposedly. How does that stand up?
I think for a lot of people, yes, things have gotten much better than they did 50 years ago. Others look at stuff like stop and search, look at the conditions of housing, look at unemployment, who make very powerful arguments that it hasn't at all. But there's also another kind of voice that I find interesting that says, that means very little if you're a 19-year-old today who's unemployed and struggling to get where you want to be in life, being told was a bit better than it was in the 60s. If they're looking at their white peers and counterparts and seeing them get where they want to in life and they're not, being told it's not as bad as it was 50 years ago, does very little for them.
Is there a danger, do you think, that this report could inflame the disputes around many of these issues rather than help address them?
I think there is definitely that fear that not enough is going to be done to support ethnic minorities, and in fact that these disparities might end up getting worse, and that this isn't just a report, this is something that the government will go on to act on. I think that's something else that's come up a lot, people saying this was a missed opportunity for systematic change.
What did you think as the findings of the report came out yesterday?
Yes, well, I had a whole range of feelings, actually. Anger, despair, and I think above all, sadness, great sadness. And
Simon Willey, who is the head of Number 10's race disparity unit, just until last summer said that, you know, this was an opportunity for the government to step up and respond for this call for change, and they've failed in doing so. And what does that mean if you're not white in the UK today?
Amna, thank you very much.
No worries, thanks so much.
That was Amna Modin. Read all of her coverage of the fallout from the Commission's report at theguardian.com, where you can also listen to a podcast we made about the impact of the pandemic in Brent last year, called How One London Neighbourhood Lost 36 Residents to COVID-19. Following the release of the report and the backlash to it, the Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities issued a statement on Friday. In it, they state, "We have never said that racism does not exist in society or in institutions. We say the contrary. Racism is real, and we must do more to tackle it. This is a wide-ranging report, and we hope it will lead to further research and better understanding of the complex causes of inequalities in the UK." That's it for today. This episode was produced by Rose Dalarabiti, and sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.